you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, all the places. And my second feature is written. Yay!
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I am in pre-production of my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep and a distribution consultant, and I used to work at Sundance. And this week, we welcome writer and director Clinton Cornwell, friend of the show, to talk about making his first feature 12 months, how he approached making the film, and why he decided to shoot the movie over the period of a year. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, Alric, how are you?
I'm doing good. The big project I was on that was just like taking every second of my life ended yesterday. So that's nice. I feel like a human again. I got to sleep actual hours yesterday.
Oh, that sounds nice.
That was cool. I don't know what's going on in filmmaking. I really haven't looked at my script much in a while, which is a little too bad. I should get back to it. I mean, it's because of this. I haven't had like a free moment, you know, but I have been thinking about it a lot. I'm really excited about it. I did get some feedback from Slam Dance, which was kind of interesting.
Oh.
Actually, why don't I just read it on the show for fun?
Just read it.
I don't know if you've ever, have you ever done this before?
No.
Where you've submitted a script to like a competition and they give you a little bit of feedback like before they give you your answer.
No.
So it's like, this is just feedback that like the reader gave, and it's like, this does not, you know, reflect on your chances of getting in or out of the festival. It doesn't matter, like this has no like relevance to your chances of making it, but
that's
here's
really
what they
cool
said.
Of them, that's very cool.
Yeah, Dan Mervish for the win. I'm assuming that he is the reason why this is happening.
Don't give Dan Mervish that much credit, I don't think.
He's not the one that orchestrated this stuff. Cool. So there's the log line I gave. In the middle of their breakup, Ricky and Amanda get mixed up in an intergalactic chase for a serum that could destroy the planet. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's okay. So, and it still had the title Pulp Science Fiction, which is not the title of the movie anymore. It's now, I think it's Ricky and the Ooze is what we're going with for the moment, which I think is a lot stronger. But they say, here's what they said. Pulp Science Fiction is an exciting script with a fun adventure on its hand. Firstly, it was submitted as horror, however, reads more so as science fiction story, perhaps loosely a thriller, yet the tone of the script doesn't quite register as horror. Oh, so boo on me for putting it in the wrong category. The story launches us into the thick of things, and while this is great for pacing, we do need a bit of world building to let us know where the arena of this film is. The scenes at play in Act One don't tell us much about character. The choices they make, their dialogue, even their quirks should help us give an idea of who they are as people and what informs their choices. However, this is missing, so it becomes difficult to connect with them as they embark on their journey. Some character work for this script would really bring it to another level. Great job. Thanks for submitting your script to Slam Dance. So I read that and I felt like, yeah, this is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
But then I read it again right now and I'm like, oh, they basically say all my characters suck.
What? Well, first of all, I really like that you just read it out loud. I think that's wonderful. I think more people should share transparently the type of feedback that artists receive in their process. So I think that's really cool. And second of all, it just really sounded like someone who wanted to empower you to keep going, but give you stuff to work on. Like it felt very cheerleadery, but without being vapid. So I thought that was great.
I felt encouraged by it. When I read it originally the first time, I felt like, yes, okay, they get it. Like they're in. Like, you know, they want more world building, which may or may not get, you know, because I don't necessarily agree with that. Like I kind of feel like this is the world and you'll figure it out as you go along, you know. Like, I don't really like a ton of exposition, you know, in your movies. Like Aliens, for example, like they basically don't tell you anything.
Yeah.
You know, they just like, it's like all you know is that it's been like over 50 years since the last movie happened and that the company is probably evil and that like people, that jobs are hard to come by. Like that's, you know, even in this like futuristic like world where space travel is like a normal thing, you know? So like, I really appreciate it, like how that movie just goes and the world building happens around you as it happens, you know. I don't know if you know this about Aliens, but there was originally a scene where you got to see from the colonist's perspective as the aliens were like killing them and like taking them over and stuff and like taking over their colony.
Yeah.
Like completely cut, completely scrapped. I don't even know if they shot it. I think it was just cut in script form, but it's like the most genius cut ever. It's like, if they had put that in the movie, it would have been so much worse. And the fact that like James Cameron got that out of that edit and like, in, you know, made the movie without it, it's like,
yeah,
the movie's like 1,000 times better for that happening.
I love Aliens. Like, for me, it's such a movie about motherhood, so I just love it so much.
Oh yeah, it is about that, which is great. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, fucking Sigourney Weaver is just incredible in that movie. Mm-hmm. And Newt, what a character. Mm-hmm. We quote Newt all day long in this house.
Oh, mostly
coming out mostly. It's everything is mostly. Yeah. But yeah, so no, I feel good about it. I mean, we were talking off air just right before we started, like, am I making this movie or not? And like, you're like, yeah, it looks like you are going to make this movie. Like, you're going to make, it's happening, right? And like, I feel like for me, like, I don't really know yet. I think I am, but I guess probably the reason why I don't feel that way at the moment is because I just haven't worked on the script, you know, since I gotten like the majority of my feedback, which a lot of people never even got back to me, by the way. People said they were going to, and like, they just never read the script yet, which is totally fine. And like, I'm not like busting balls over that, because like, I know it needs more work anyways. So like, I'll just bother them, you know, when the next draft is done. But the feedback I did get, it was kind of in line with that line I just read, which was pretty much like, the characters are all kind of similar and they don't feel individual enough. And so you just need to like work on the dialogue to make them all kind of sound a little different, which I think I talked about on the show before.
Yeah, I was about to say, you've said that about your own writing. So that makes sense.
Yeah. And like alternate was the same, you know? And so like, I feel like that's the work to do now, and it's the hard work. So,
yeah.
But now that I'm like off this project and I have a little bit more free time, I think that's going to be the next stage. And then I need to identify what blocks of this movie, like, how would I shoot this? Like, what pieces would I do at the same time over a 4-day weekend? And what block do I want to do first? And then once I have that figured out, then I can start budgeting the blocks. Mm-hmm. And be like, oh, okay, I think this block will cost me $40,000. I think this block will cost me $20,000, you know, whatever. So that's like the, you know, there's two big things to do, is like, first the script, and then like the blocking and the budgeting. And then even within that, trying to figure out like, okay, in the first block that I shoot, what is the short film version of this that I could submit to film festivals to get people excited about the project? Like, what piece of the movie would I boil down to a short and include that could also stay in the full movie? Mm-hmm. So that's another thing. And then actually, really quick, I know I'm talking a lot, but I had this one question for you. Do you think that's a good idea, or do you think that's stupid to like shoot a piece of a movie and then like submit, like continue to raise money, to continue to work on the other thing, but while you're doing that, like, create like a short film out of the first part of the movie and then use that to like raise more money and to like, you know, get submit to film festivals and stuff? Or do you think that's like, or do you think that's crazy?
There's no blanket answer to this, because it is a strategy that a lot of filmmakers do. It's just about personal preference. But what came to mind for me were two things. One is, as long as you're controlling the elements of production, like, it's your equipment, your editing, your direct, you know, you're taking on a lot of that and you're not outsourcing it, I think that's probably really important, because you don't want to expend too much budget on this, because you don't really know if it's going to be in the final product until you're in the edit. But the second thing I was thinking about was the babysitter murders segment of the mortuary. I always say it wrong. I always think it's Mortuary Chronicles, but it's the mortuary
collection.
Yeah. So it's the one that I don't think it is, but how he started with that first, and then he built the short and then the anthology around that. And that was very successful for him. It took him years, but it still was the way he launched the whole project. So I would love to see, like, is there kind of a siloed sequence that you have in your script right now? Because the Babysitter Murders has that like throwback movie within a movie that I thought was pretty exciting, right? Is like, is there something kind of like really pulpy that you have in your film right now that would be illustrative, or illustrative of the tone of the film?
Yeah,
maybe that's the way to go.
I don't know. I kind of feel like it would be like, because the way I was thinking about originally, it wouldn't be like I would just shoot the footage that would be for the short. I would shoot like everything that I could within 4 days. And like, some of it would be included in the short, some of it would just be like for later or whatever. So it'd be like, I would be working on like the whole movie, and I probably would edit everything together into one. So like, you could see the segments that, you know, without the other pieces around it. But yeah, that is interesting to think about. Like, what is it, and how is it going to tell the story of the movie? You know, by itself. That's like the
what's like the peak fun, like the peak fun of your film.
The peak fun that's not like too expensive, and then also not like that connects well enough to like show you more of the movie, you know? Yeah. So yeah, definitely interesting. Anyways, what's going on with you, Liz? What you got?
Well, everything you said was really interesting, by the way. So
cool.
I shot my Kickstarter pitch video on Thursday, and producer Eric Toms and my husband were the two stars in addition to me. And Eric Toms is hilarious. And I'm not just saying that because he's going to hear this later and decide whether to keep it in or not for our episode. But like, like people came up to me afterwards and were like, that guy is very funny. So I'm super excited to show his work in the video. And in addition to that, I am yet again redoing the deck for Best Friends Forever. We have a whole new idea of how to refurbish our deck. And then even though I swore off all fellowship and lab applications, I have submitted to both Gotham and the Half Initiative already. And so I'm just waiting to be rejected by those while I wait to succeed in the funding of my feature film. So we've got a lot of like devising materials for people to accept or reject. Like that's where I am right now, is like I'm in a very pitch centric place.
Whatever happened with that actor that you had lunch with? Like, is she attached to the project? Is she still deciding? Like, what's the deal on that?
I've never done this, but I'm going to say the only way you could get that information is if you join the Patreon or if I text you later, Alric. But it's not something I'm actually going to share on the podcast. I'm redirecting everyone to the Patreon if you want to learn about that.
Fun. Yeah. Okay. Exciting.
I've never been not transparent, but I really can't talk about it on the podcast.
So. No. I mean, and that's great. I mean, it's why you have the Patreon, right? Like that's the inside track. That's how you get the VIP status, you know?
It's my Patreon for Best Friends Forever. But also if you join, this is a good segue. If you join the podcast Patreon, I'm sure there's some cool way we can like share coveted information on the podcast to podcast listeners. That website is patreon.com/MMIH podcast. And just to finish the segue, we have a new patron, Brian Silverman, who is a lovely, lovely human. And his film, Two Lives in Pittsburgh, is fantastic. And I ripped it. So I just have to, again, shout out a client. Good job, Brian. You're amazing. Without any more delay, here's our chat with Clinton Cornwell. Can you give us the elevator pitch for 12 Months?
Yeah, 12 Months is a very realistic, romantic comedy movie. It's called 12 Months because it's about a couple in their first year together. And we sort of shot it boyhood style, in that when we set out to make the film, we shot for a couple days on the first month of the film, only having written the first month of the film. And all the dialogue was improvised. So really by writing, I mean a very rough outline. And then over the next real time year, we made the film 1 month at a time, wrote it as we went along. And we didn't have a preset path. Just like, you know, when you embark upon an actual relationship in real life, you don't know how it's going to end up. We didn't know how the relationship between our fictional characters was going to end up. And so it was an amazing sort of experience. Ended up taking us like 2 years to make it. But I think the results of that kind of unique process was the film has some very sort of authentic elements to it for some that are even a bit painful.
Ooh, I want to get into that later. How many days did you shoot across those 2 years? Do you know? Did you guys keep track?
Yeah, because we labeled the footage per day. So we did, with all total, we did 60.
Wow.
Over a little more than 2 years, or around 2 years, I think. So, yeah.
What was the rough budget?
I would say, well, Liz, we've been talking about these kind of things. It's like, what is the cash budget versus what is the actual like time and resources of people going into the project? I'd say the cash budget was like $60,000. But if you take deferments and, you know, all of the people who worked for free on the project and, you know, will be owed like a percentage of profits as a result, I'd say for us to get into the black we probably have to generate over 150,000, I'd say.
Wow. How did you come up with the idea, and specifically like the idea of making the movie in this way? Was it just a Boyhood ripoff, or was there some other origin of why you did this?
No, I mean, it definitely, I mean, I personally am always kind of interested. I've been interested in relationships. Like, you know, I'm a single man. I've never been married or anything like that. And I've always wanted a partner. So I've always been interested in exploring relationships in my films, romantic relationships. I had made several short films about relationships before 12 Months, which is my first feature. So that always kind of interested me. And then, yeah, I love Boyhood. I love lots of Linklater films for sure. But I watched Boyhood, and that had a big impact on me. And I just sort of turned my mind in the direction of like this making a film in real time, like what other types of stories could that benefit? You know, how could that format be not just as like a gimmick, but like how could it actually enhance the storytelling in the film? And I remember I was like the image in my head at the moment that I came up with 12 Months, which is like I was driving down Mulholland Drive at night, and it just kind of hit me all at once, which was like this romantic story of a couple in their first year together, and like let's actually make it over that year. And then I was especially excited at the time because, you know, as a filmmaker, I'm not just excited by ideas alone. I get maybe momentarily for like a day or so, I'll be excited by an idea. But the ones that really stick with me are when the ideas meet the resources. And, you know, doing a micro budget feature, I was like, oh, the time element not only could benefit the storytelling, but logistically, finance wise, like people's time commitment wise, kind of doing like block shooting could really benefit sort of the making of the film and make it a lot more doable. And, you know, at the time, I was just working a job, you know, 40 hours a week, making $15 an hour. And I was like, you know what, I could probably afford to pay for this if we shot it this way. And so that's all of that kind of combined in the moment to get me really excited to make the movie. And it took me a while to actually get to doing it, but that it was so doable was definitely part of what was exciting about it.
So you're driving down Mulholland. What year was that? And then what was the full duration from then until now?
This is sometime in 2015. So it's been like 9 years since I came up with the idea, you know. And the funny thing was, I mean, it took me a couple of years. We started production in June 2017 because I didn't have a male lead at the time. So it took me a couple of years to find the right person to fit that mold and to be able to have the, I mean, making a movie for that kind of time period is no small ask. So it takes a particular personality, which I'm so grateful to the team that I had on the film and their dedication to seeing the thing all the way through. It's insane.
If you could change one thing about the movie in any way, it could be like the actual movie itself. It could be the process to making the movie. It could be like anything. What would that be?
Everybody always gives soft answers to this question. You know, that's always like, oh, some factor outside of my control. I wish I could change it. And I honestly, you know, something that's lovely about making the film the way that we did is you could see for me the visual and like the blocking elements level up as the film goes along. And so now I look back at the beginning of the film and like my focus was so much on like, let's just get it done. Like, let's just make sure we're able to make these scenes and get it done. And I think as a result, like the cinematography and like the blocking of the characters, sort of the visual storytelling elements really suffered early on in the film. And I wish that I had pushed harder in the beginning of the film to kind of visually tell the story more. And that was something that we learned a lot about as we went along. And, you know, luckily we have the ability to reflect on that and learn from that. But I still look at the beginning of the film and I'm just like, this is not up to snuff. This is not what I would want it to be.
So you said that you like when your resources match the idea and you have this very ambitious plan, this 12-month plan, but I think you may be understating maybe how difficult it is to get people to commit for that long of a production, right? Mm-hmm. So I'd be curious why you think people said yes to you.
Because they believe in me. That's it. That's the only reason. Like, I knew that I had a cinematographer, Dustin LaBeouf, who believed in me and believed what we were doing. And I had a lead female actor, Elizabeth Hirschtauber, who believed in me and what we were doing. And I thought these people also were good enough to go on the ride with me, right? Like, I had done enough films at that point to be able to raise my standards with like the types of people that I was working with So it's not just like they were the only ones or something like that. And then, you know, I was looking around in my space and I just didn't have the kind of relationship with a male actor, or at least one that I thought was good enough or that I trusted enough to go on the journey with us. But then I was for a short while part of a film collective, which didn't really go anywhere. I didn't make any things with them or anything like that. Kind of fell apart shortly after I joined it. But I did get to meet some great people. And one of those people was Michael Kelly. And I think through that process, Michael got to know me and my films and the work I had done. And he had got to know me as like a filmmaker and a creative. So in that sense, like, he could see the value in working with me. And also I had seen his work and gotten to know him. And I could say, oh, this guy's really great. And so, you know, I talked to Elizabeth about it beforehand. And I was like, this Michael guy, let's talk to him. I think we can make this work. And, you know, it wasn't all, when you're making a film over that timeline, there were so many times I thought it could fail. And like, I had this massive anxiety for like 2 years that we wouldn't finish the project. But now I look back at it and somehow it all worked out. And God, I feel so lucky that Dustin, Elizabeth, and Michael were so fucking dedicated. And like, I'm like, how did these people trust me to do this thing? Because essentially they were all just making a bet on me. And God, I'm so lucky to have had them, for sure. I know on the show, there's a big conversation about just going out and making things. And like, these people were able to have faith in me because I went out and I've consistently made things all the time. Right. And I'm like challenging myself to like grow with every film and try new things. And I have a real focus on like collaboration and creating a good environment with my collaborators as a director. And I take all that stuff very seriously. So I think, you know, while those things may not have direct explicit effects, obviously I'm not directing a Marvel movie, there's still a lot of benefit. Like, I was able to make 12 months because of that kind of approach to my work.
So can you just break down how you did your block shooting? Like, was it just like one day on a weekend, or did you do like 3 days in a row, or was it just dependent on the scene? And how did you manage locations for that? Like, did you have to go back to the same locations over and over again and just like make sure that you had a good arrangement with people? Like, how was that? How did that work?
Yeah, I think it was almost the phases were like, phase one was like resource gathering in a certain way. Like, let me think about, you know, whose places do we have to shoot in? What exterior locations do you think could be reasonable? We ended up shooting a lot in Burbank, California, because at the time you didn't need permits to shoot there if your crew was under a certain size and everything was handheld, which handheld was going into the aesthetic of the film. And I was, from the get-go, we planned to shoot it very small. Like most days we shot, it was just like a 4-person crew or less. Sometimes, you know, 2-person crew a lot of times too. So that allowed us to be very nimble. And we knew that we had sort of like Burbank as like, we won't have any problems with the cops here. So it's like, we have Burbank. I know which like places that we have, which apartments we could potentially shoot in, you know, keeping that conversation going consistently. And then the other part of the resource gathering was, because we were writing it as we went along, I would sit down with Elizabeth and with Michael, and we would kind of have like, Michael called them our therapy sessions. And we would dive into each of our relationship experiences that were germane to sort of the phase that our couple on screen was in. And we just sort of, it wasn't like, oh, how do we turn this into a story in this moment? It was just like, let's just talk about this and let's share our experiences. And then after having that meeting within each of them, that was kind of the resource gathering. I would take those resources of like all of our individual like romantic experiences and kind of synthesize the scenarios, because we didn't write a proper script because it's all improvised dialogue. But I would synthesize kind of like the broad scenario for the month that we were going to shoot. And then I would assess how many days we were going to do that. And, you know, usually it was 2 to 3 days. And I would try and group them all together, because getting people to do 2 or 3 days in a row is a lot easier than like, hey, let's do a day here, day here, day here. And then also there's like this momentum. This is the hard lesson that I had to learn, was that if you separate out the shooting days, that means you have to return all the equipment. You have to take it up and you have to take it into your apartment and out of your apartment. And there was a lot of stairs leading to my apartment. And it's like, whereas if it's all booked together, you leave a bunch of it in your car. You don't have to tear apart your spaces as much as possible. And so I'm super happy that we did shoot it the way that we did. It wouldn't have been any other way that I could have done a feature at that point. but something I didn't anticipate was the sort of the wind up energy required and the wind down energy required for each individual block of shooting. It was like, it wasn't like, oh, we're prepped with everything and now we're good for the whole 12 months. It was like, no, each month was a short film with its own pre-production and, you know, kind of recovery.
Going back a little bit, you know, you went to FSU, you went to film school, you worked for, I'll just say, a Hollywood actor and his wife. You get to say, you know, whether we got that out or not.
Yeah.
But many people who come from that background, they kind of have that cognitive dissonance of like, I've invested all this money. I need $5 million for my first feature. I need to come out big. I need to come out commercial. You clearly are very thoughtful, and I understand why you were geared towards this process. But did you have any misgivings about this being your first feature, or did you have any thoughts or desires to make a bigger first project?
No, I don't think I ever thought about that, because I learned even back then, I just heard from other people's experiences through film festivals, and I'm always like a very curious person about other filmmakers' experiences, is like, even though I thought, you know, if I really wanted to, I could probably do some fundraising for it. I heard even people who were trying to raise small amounts of money was taking years and years to get that stuff going. And I just didn't want to participate in that process. I wanted to make something as soon as I could make it for the experience of it, because I knew that making 12 months would be a massive learning experience. And I also had already sort of gotten the sense that just making things like brings more to you in the world. Like it yields positive results, even if you can't pinpoint exactly what those results are going to be. And so I knew that back then. And so it just made sense to me, like, instead of pursuing this, you know, whatever millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars for years for, you know, all money comes with strings attached to it and all this stuff, I'm just going to go and do this crazy free flowing creative process and let's just do it and let's just see what happens, you know. And I even told the team at the beginning of the process, I was like, hey guys, I don't know if this is going to make a single cent in money. I don't know what the results of this process are going to be at all. This, you know, worst case scenario, this thing just ends up on YouTube streaming for free. Like, this is all within the realm of possibility. We may not even finish it. Who knows? Shit happens when you're making a movie over the course that over a year. And I told everybody that up front. And part of that was even just for myself to refocus on like this process, focus on what are we doing now with this movie and how can that be useful to us, and not worry so much about, oh yeah, how's this going to, you know, get me the next thing as much. Because I think a lot of that stuff is kind of random, honestly. So I question how useful it is to be so focused on the results of films as opposed to just like, what is the process of making the film? And this was a crazy ass process. I mean, and another thing too, I think maybe my brain is just broken and it works this way. I don't have kids. I'm not married. You know, that stuff is certainly relevant when you have kids and you need to make money. Like that changes the equation a little bit more for sure. But also just for me, it's like, I went to film school because I wanted to make creative pieces of art, you know? And like, I never was disabused of that notion. Like, I've never been somebody that's like, oh, I need to make money right away. Like, I feel like most people figure out a way to make a living in America and in much of the world, right? So why should that be my number one goal? I'm more here trying to develop a lifestyle, trying to create art, and that's always been my North Star, and I haven't been shaken of that. And I think people get shaken of that with what you were talking about, Liz, that pressure of like, I have to make money, I have to justify this film school degree. I still got $150,000 in school debt, so, but like, you know, I'm managing that, and it's just a part of a factor of like the lifestyle I've chosen for myself.
What year did you graduate as of state?
Florida State. I graduated in
Florida State. Okay.
Yeah, Florida State. 2013, the end of August 2013. I moved out to LA in 2014.
Nice.
I mean, when I first moved out here, I did like the, should I get into the industry thing? You know, I was like talking to people about maybe trying to get into an agency mailroom. I applied to that a bit, applied to be at WME. And then I was lucky, as Liz alluded to, I got a really great sort of industry job as my first job. I was working for Seth Rogen and his wife, Lauren Miller Rogen, as their personal assistant. It's like my first job in that first year that I was here. And that's like amazing. But during this time, I was just also listening and meeting with people and asking people for advice and like hearing about their past. And like something that struck me is like nobody was actually doing anything creative. You know, everybody was working in the industry as like assistants and all these like, you know, supposedly quote unquote successful industry jobs. But like they were eating their entire lives and all of their energy and all of their time. And all of these people were just like everybody to a T wanted to be more creative. And so I was like, why don't I put the creativity first? And towards the end of 2014, I made my first short film in LA because I wanted that challenge. It was called Kiss and Tell, a little romantic first date thing. But I was like, I want to try this improv thing again. I want to make a short film in LA and see what that experience is like. And that was sort of, you know, that just felt so good that I was like, okay, I just need to keep putting this stuff first.
So I know that you already made another feature after this one that's in post-production.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about like, you know, it's a horror feature. So one, why switch to the genre to horror? And then two, how were you able to bring that movie together? Is like, did you have to raise money for this one or are you doing a similar approach to it?
No, my second feature, working title is JPV, totally working title, but it's a found footage horror film. And that was like, instead of going bigger, I went smaller than 12 months in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, it was like a pandemic thing. And it was like, hey, we all got time. I got some extra money. The budget was smaller, and the shoot was a lot smaller to match. And it was kind of just like, hey, let's all go to a cabin in the woods for a few weeks and make this film. And the turn into horror, I mean, I personally become a lot more interested in horror. My mom passed in 2019, and I think I had liked horror films before then, but I found myself as a way of kind of like processing the grief of my mother's passing. I dove really deep into horror in terms of watching it. And horror films have definitely become my comfort food. And then also just like strategically as a filmmaker, you know, we all talk a lot about the more of a hunger for genre films. But even just for me, it's like you pitch somebody 12 months or an idea like it and you just see their eyes kind of glaze over, like unless you can give like the most compelling pitch in the world. But every time I pitch a genre film, people kind of like lean in. And I think there's an energy there to even making genre films. People can get excited about them. They're excited about the process of making it. They're excited about the process. Just the idea of like bringing that kind of idea to life and you know, I think I get fed by that energy a bit. So I think strategically it makes sense as an indie filmmaker I like it and I feel the energy from the world wanting it and those things unite. So I have definitely turned in that direction and definitely got I've got that horror feature and four more horror shorts that I'm trying to finish up that I've directed them all and excited to get that stuff out in the world and see what the reception is and pivot from there.
I have a question, Clinton, that you may want to strike from the record, so we'll see how comfortable you are with it.
Unlikely.
I don't know. It's about money. So, you know, you mentioned you have debt, and you also mentioned that you're able to self-fund some of these movies because, you know, you've chosen your disposable income to go into these projects rather than take vacation or whatever it is, right?
Yeah,
you know, however you budget your time and money. With the debt kind of like looming over you and the fact that it's like, as we get older, I always have this fear of like always needing a fuck you fund, no matter what. Even if I'm working for myself, I want a fuck you fund for myself. Like, what if I have to leave my self-employment and say fuck you to myself, right? So like, I guess my question for you is, you have a very calm, thoughtful process, how you evaluate the world, how you decide to proceed in art. But this money thing may come to a head at some point for you, right? How do you deal with that? What do you think? What are your plans with regard to money and art?
Well, I think the first thing is through life experiences. You know, I was lucky to have an experience when I was younger where I kind of like, I just sold all of my possessions and booked a one-way trip to Europe and was just kind of like making up my trip, this backpacking trip through Europe as I went along. I didn't have any plan and I just figured it out as I went. And that experience really taught me, it's like, oh, no matter what happens, like, it's probably not going to be that bad. I'll figure it out. Like, I'll figure it out. We'll make the best of this. You know, it gave me sort of like because there was days where one of the worst days on my trip was I was walking for miles and miles and miles in the rain on a stormy night and ended up like sleeping overnight in a train station. And You know, I definitely made mistakes on that night and I reflected on them, but I was like, well, this, I was just a homeless person for a little bit. Like I was sleeping under the overhang of somebody's house so I could get out of the rain for a little bit. And that wasn't fun, but it also, like, I was fine, you know? And so I think I learned from that experience, like, I will figure it out. And also, like, if it gets bad, like, I'm not dead. I'm, you know, like, and if you're not dead, you can figure something else out, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're talking about the fuck you. I think me making these movies is my fuck you. Like, I'm proactively doing the fuck you because, like, all of this is just whatever I want to be. I'm guided by what inspires me. I'm guided by what I care about in my life and being able to make art about that. And then the rest of it, yeah, it's like I got student loans and the payments are small enough on that and there's flexibility with that. It's not that I don't have anxiety about these things. It's not that I don't have stress about these things, but I do my research. I educate myself about my student loans or whatever other financial management things. I make the best choices that I can in the moment. And I just sort of, you know, understand that sure, mistakes will be made and we'll figure it out as we go. And I mean, everybody does. So why can't I? Pretty much everybody figures out how to make a living, right? Like,
yeah, but I think you're very forgiving of there's a lot of self-love going on that I'm not familiar with as a concept. It's very confusing. You know, it's confusing to me. So it's interesting.
Self-acceptance, right? Really, because yeah. I mean, I think you have to as a filmmaker, because like all we get constantly is rejection and failure. And it's like endless. And if you can't, nobody else is going to give you a break. So you better learn to give yourself a break or else you're never going to make it as a filmmaker. Right. Like I'm not trying to be you're a kid. You're never going to make it as a filmmaker. But like, really, like we all know here in this conversation, it's just filled with so much. There's so much down for every up that you get. And if you're not able to forgive yourself when you inevitably are going to make decisions that lead you to those downs, then you're just going to quit. And that's okay. Maybe it wasn't for you. But I think, I mean, learning those tools of resiliencies are almost as much a part of being a filmmaker as any of the creative tools.
So, you know, you've got, you know, two low budget features, you know, one's out, one's coming out, you know, in the near future. Like what's the game plan for all this content you're making? Are you just getting it out to as many people as possible so you can like meet new people, make more connections and like make another movie? Or are you trying to level up with each movie? Well, obviously you're not because you went down for the second one.
But what does level up even mean though? Honestly, and being somebody who listens to this podcast and consumes a lot of filmmaking content, there's so much a focus on what is the results of our work. And I think that's, you're like putting the cart before the horse in a lot of ways. And I a lot of people fall into that mindset, I feel like, of we have to go for this result, and then they lose sight of the process. And a lot of the results of our work is so outside of our control, right? You know, you can do everything in the world to prepare yourself as much as you can, but like ultimately how your film's going to be received is, there's so many factors that are outside of your control. And so I try and be more strategic rather than attach myself to particular outcomes, if that makes sense. Like, you know, turning into horror a little bit, that's a strategic decision because I think it sets you up for more of a kind of likely leveling up or likely good results. But I also know that it's like nothing's guaranteed there. And so I try and focus on, well, how do I do films that are interesting to me, that are going to challenge me, that I'm going to learn from? And not only, I mean, every film is always going to do that for you, but I think if you go in with that mindset ahead of time, you are more open to learning. You're more open to growing. You're more open to like the different like intangible benefits of making a film. And so for me, it's like every film is its own goal. It's just like keep finishing each film. And like, as the podcast says, each movie you make is so fucking difficult to get done. Like, and you need to, we're going to pile all these other goals on top of just the massive Herculean effort of getting a fucking film done. it's like you're putting so much weight on yourself. And for me, it's like, just keep getting the work done and then I'll assess how I feel as I go. I think it's lovely, Ulrich, you've been kind of having this conversation with yourself on air. It's been great to hear it play out, of like dealing with the fact of being a parent and a father and also wanting to be a filmmaker, and sort of you've been in real time, we've been hearing you feel that out for yourself, right? And I don't think that would have been helpful for you to attach like, well, but I need to be here in this number of years, and if I'm not, I'm then I'm failed everything. Steven Spielberg made his first feature. He made Jaws at 25. So, you know, I should just go kill myself because I'm 30 now and I haven't done shit. You know, I don't know that that stuff is helpful for a creative life.
No, I know. I totally agree. What I'm kind of getting at more is like, you know, like if you think of each movie as its own goal to make the movie, like I think that's beautiful. But like at the end part of the move of making it, like it needs to also in a way be a tool to get the next movie made. And I feel like in order for it to be that, like I think people need to see it, right? And like getting it out into the world is like really important. And we've had a lot of guests on the show recently, which I will not name names, but that they don't feel like getting it out to the world does not seem like to be the most important thing. And it's like, well, but then why would you make it if you're not going to try to push it out?
I think that's,
you
know, an essential part of the process for sure. Right. Is like, I don't think the art is fully complete until you get it out into the world and you see how the world reflects from it. But it's just a part of the process, you know, and there's lots of other steps to it. Yeah, I mean, I agree, like getting the work out there through marketing, through different channels and stuff like that, that is important because people got to see the work so that they can appreciate you. But also, do you want to become a marketer as your full-time career? Is that what we're doing? I think what gets lost more than anything is people need to make a good movie first. And that's right. That's actually, you know, a lot of these results, I think, don't come to people, and maybe this is being harsh, and maybe, you know, maybe this is pointing just at myself as much as anything. A lot of these results don't come to people probably because they didn't make a good enough movie, I think.
Yeah, not really though. I think it's more like this idea of like having a goal for, like you say, the goal to make the movie is the movie, right? But like, yeah. I think beyond that, like there should be some sort of end goal for where the movie is going to go, whether it's like for your case with the horror movie, like genre film festivals, like that's the place where you meet fans and that's where the place where the movie gets out to more people, you know? And I feel like with each movie that you make, like you should be thinking about like how is it going to potentially lead to the next movie? But do you not consider that in when you make something? It's more just like, this is the art and it, like, I guess the other two-part question. One, I'm sorry, Liz, I'm kind of taking over. But yeah, like one part would be like, okay, like, is there a goal? Is there an endpoint goal for the movie besides making the movie? And the second question is, if the movie doesn't live up to what you were thinking about in the first place, would you not release it? Or will you always release your work no matter what?
Second question first, I'll always release the work. It's very big to me. Always complete your work. Always finish every project in some form. Like, do not abandon them. Put them all out into the world. I hate that people hide their early projects and they're like ashamed about them, because you're creating a false narrative about yourself, you know, and creativity is a process. And it's, you know, you have to fail so much before you can succeed. And I think, you know, it's a little disingenuous to just hide the work that you don't like, instead of like showing the fullness of your creativity. But that's a whole other conversation about culture and, you know, this idea that you can't show your failures and stuff like that. No, I mean, I do think a lot about the results. I mean, for me and Liz was the distribution consultant on 12 Months. And a big part of that conversation was, hey, I'm viewing film festivals as the main release for this film, because this is a film that I want to make a good film and hopefully get the attention of other people who would want to continue to work with me and support me. You know, and I think all this stuff is related, Ulrich, because, I mean, think of yourself if you're not a filmmaker, if you're not a director, like what kind of directors and filmmakers do you want to attach yourself to? You know, do you want to attach yourself to people who make really great movies and have great creative processes and are fun collaborators to work with? Is that what you're on the lookout for? People who have the confidence in their art form? Or do you want to attach yourself to people who make really great social media posts. And like, these things are not one or the other. It's not black or white, right? But like, the social media posts are ultimately to pull people in to say, hey, this is a great process. I'm an artist with integrity. I am serious about what I'm doing, and I want to bring you along with me, you know? And so for me, there's so much noise in the world that tries to get you to pay attention to the other things, because the other things is what you see. You need to market yourself better. You need to be on social media more. You need to be networking more. But all that stuff to me is to pull people into hopefully the great processes that you're already cultivating for yourself and the great creative processes. And so I try and focus more on that part first and hold myself accountable on that part first. And also, you know, selfishly, that's the part I enjoy. That's the part that's fun, that fulfills me. That's why I got into doing all this stuff. And so there's probably been parts of my career where I could have been more strategic, and I'm in a space of kind of trying to reevaluate that stuff. I think on our hikes, me and Liz, we talk a lot about these kinds of things consistently, because it's hard to figure out that balance. But I personally see a lot in the world people erring too much the side of focusing on the results of their work and how do you market it? How do you get distribution? All these other things. And like, to me, it's like, well, let's really focus on how do we make a great movie first.
I know we're getting close to even asking our ending questions, but I think the through line for this overall conversation is this issue, right? Is results-oriented process, paying attention to these things, not being so bottom line about everything. But I am very results-oriented. It's like in my core, right? And I would say, just speaking for some of us who use filmmaking as therapy, sometimes a review makes you feel seen in a way that you never saw yourself before. So I remember Bears Fonte, she said, my film had spinster weirdness. And I was like, that's me. I'm a weird spinster. Like, you see me. And it was so thrilling, right? So my question for you is, where do you find the most ecstasy in the process then? I mean, I know there's a whole landscape that you've referred to, but can you talk about one moment where you're like, this is it. This is why I'm here.
Yeah. And I don't think there's anything wrong with getting, you know, that sounds amazing. Now, that's an awesome review to have gotten. Like, there's nothing wrong with feeling good about results or going on the journey of like, oh, this didn't work the way that
I
wanted.
But it does motivate some of us. It does.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But, you know, I think I worry about that because you're being motivated by something that isn't within your control, ultimately, you know?
Yeah, but that's a conversation with someone else, which is exciting, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's exciting to view your work through someone else's eyes, and I get high off of that. I know it's not within your control, but that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, and I'm not some Zen master who's detached from the results of anything. Things, you
but
know?
I think you're trying to be, Clinton. But please,
no,
tell me about ecstasy.
That's also a strategy. That's also a strategy, too, because like showing it to an audience is inherent to the work. So you almost don't need to focus on that part because it's going to come to you anyways, right? Mm. And that can be motivating, but also I think it can be fleeting. And so I try and focus on the more internal processes because that's a more consistent source of motivation. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's, I don't think that it's a coincidence. People keep calling me a very prolific filmmaker, which I have a little bit of mixed feelings about. But the fact is, I always have so many projects going because I can more consistently source that motivation for myself. You know, it's the exciting part, most exciting part of my life is to get up and go make movies. You ask what's the most, like, those bursts of inspiration where you just get hit with something that is like so much greater than everything you've been going towards, like everything coalesces in like a moment. And you're like, oh my God, that's the thing. Whether it's an idea when you're prepping, whether it's when you're in your third draft of your script and like this new, like better version of a scene comes to you, whether it's a moment of inspiration on set. I love being on set the most. I like, God, hours just drip away from me on set. Like, I don't need to eat. I don't need to sleep. I don't need to go to the bathroom for like 16 hours at a time. Like, I'm just so focused and in the moment on set. And that's definitely part of the motivation too, is I know I have that amazing place I can go to. But like those moments on set where it's like, oh my God, what the fuck are we going to do? Oh, great. This other amazing idea that we had never thought of comes to us. Like that stuff is so great. And like you get those opportunities so rarely in life. And there's so few other places in life where you can. It's such a unique experience. And like, I'm so grateful to be a part of it. Like that's, I don't know if you guys feel that way about set, but I'm like, let me fucking capture that lightning as much as I can, as often as I can.
That's why people jump on your projects, Clinton, because you find the process so joyful. And yeah, they want that high too.
Maybe you want to edit this out, but like, this has been a conversation me and you have been having consistently. That I think that is within you. It's just not the place that you lean towards automatically, you know? And maybe I'm not saying I'm right, but also it's like you're listening to the voices of the world, and the voices of this world and our American culture and all these things tell you, you got to have the results. You got to be successful. Why aren't your films bigger on your resume and all this? And you have this lovely feedback thing, Liz, of like, you worked for Sundance and that has like this massive effect on everything you do. And like, that's great. Fucking yes. Own that. That's amazing that you had that opportunity. But also it's sort of like, I don't know. In our conversations, I think you feel the disconnect between that result and kind of like what you truly want and are excited about with the process.
But enough about me.
Well, I coached both you guys at different times. So we've jumped. I have extra insight into each of your creative processes a little bit. So it's hard not to jump into that a little bit. So
do you think that you're just going to keep going on the way that you're going where, you know, you get the budget together with your own money, you do them, you know, small and just as long as it's a story you believe in, you just keep on making those movies? Or do you see that like eventually, you know, you're going to pursue a bigger endeavor where you like you do raise like 100,000, 200,000 or something through investors and, you know, put that kind of time and energy into making the movie? Or is that just that bone that like that piece of it doesn't exist in it for you? Like, that's just not what you want to do with your time.
No. I think about that stuff. And this is going to be a little bit of an annoying answer, I think. But I don't know really at all. Like, doesn't have to be one way or the other. You know, I feel like as I complete each project, because right now I'm focused on completing all these films that are in post-production. That's step one. But as I do that, I want to keep open to sort of feeling how I feel about the work and how I want to pursue the work and what the world is telling me, right? I feel like as you continue to put the work out there, that stuff can come into your life. Like just by releasing 12 months, there's been people who've come into my life have been like, yes, let's do this. Let's raise money. Let's do the thing, you know? And so I do want to listen to that, but I think you can kind of do both. Honestly, you can be developing, and maybe I'm wrong. Talk to me again in like a year when I've released the next film and maybe I'll have a different approach, but I think you can dedicate the time to the longer term process of trying to get big projects going. And then you can do small projects in between that creatively fulfill you. And I'll just sort of feel out the energy of how do I want to dedicate my time to that stuff as I go along. You know, if I'm feeling like there's a momentum with a bigger budget project and I want to put my time towards that, I'll do it. And if I'm feeling like itchy to go get back in the creative mix, I'll go make something small with whatever resources that I can. I'm insanely grateful to, I think I've come to a place as a creative that I know that whatever topic I'm passionate about or whatever I'm thinking about in my life or whatever I'm trying to change in myself, I can go make a movie about that whenever I want. You know, through hook or through crook, I can pull together the things that I need to make something about what interests me in my life. And I will have that at my fingertips for the rest of my life. And of course, I want to level up my career. I want to make bigger budget movies. I want to do all those things. But also, that doesn't happen for a lot of people. So why would I assume that it's definitely going to happen for me? And instead, you know, I know that I can keep making movies for as long as I want to make them. And I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Well, let's segue from that to our final six questions. What's the first film you've ever made and how do you feel about it now?
The first real film was called The Rose. I made it during undergrad at UNLV back in 2007. I was very Fight Club inspired then. I loved darkness. I was like one of those males. I want to make something dark and really meaningful and says really something about the world, you know? And so now, you know, I love it, actually. I'm very proud of it because I can see it's a time capsule to the person that I was at that time in my life. And also, I think it's the punching in all directions of like a young filmmaker and a young storyteller who didn't know any better. And so it's very different from who I am today, but I love that it exists.
What's the best filmmaking advice that you've ever received?
My professor, dearly departed Francisco Menendez, we had a class called Advanced Directing. And something that was amazing advice for me in that class is that the first job of a director is to work with the actors, because nobody else on set is there to work with the actors except for the director. And I took that very seriously. And I think it's really guided a lot of my creative processes. And still to this day, working with actors is one of my favorite parts of the process. So
share some bad filmmaking advice with us, Clinton.
I don't know if it's an advice from one person, but it's definitely the idea that we need to compete, especially with our peers. You know, I feel like directors, I mean, this podcast and it has been so helpful because directors don't share information with each other as a general rule. And I think it's the sense that we need to compete with each other, which I think is just completely false. Like, if you're going to succeed, you're going to succeed on the uniqueness of your own voice and your own talent. And competition doesn't play into that at all. And frankly, like, if somebody in your space succeeds, that actually ups your chances of succeeding. So we're all pulling each other down when we should be lifting each other up. So anybody who trumpets that we need to compete is really hurting you and everybody around you.
Ditto. Love that. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Just finish these movies, man. Each movie is its own goal. That's it. And I don't spend too much time thinking on the big overarching goals beyond that. Let's just keep making these movies.
If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you would give yourself?
I would say just get started, because the road to success is paved with failures. So get out there and start failing.
I wanted to throw out a bonus question because you know all the questions so well and I couldn't think of one, but I'll think of one after this.
Oh, no,
but
do it. I'm excited for
okay.
this.
What's the most challenging moment that you've ever had on set, and how did you overcome it?
Challenging moment. You know what? I think the most I like to err towards the edgy side of things, and especially when in my process working with actors and doing creative stuff and being inspired in the moment, I like to shoot all of the colors of the rainbow. And sometimes that means going to the darkest, worst, edgiest kind of place as a part of that process. And then you kind of like find the middle. But I've definitely had this has happened several times where you get up to that edge and it makes people really uncomfortable, especially the actors who are having to portray in that moment. And I try to approach that very gently, because I don't want to ever be this like dictator director who is like, oh, my vision must be, you must support my vision. It's the most important thing in the world. And I don't want to ever, you know, victimize or exploit anybody along that path. And so when we hit that edge and somebody's got a problem with it, I try to just very like really listen to what their issues are, what their complaints are, try and share with them the like the creative reasons why I think it's important. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I feel like I've made the mistake and creatively compromised myself too far to make people comfortable. And sometimes we found happy middle grounds. And that made people happy too. But those are always the hardest moments, when somebody's like, you are going too far. This is too far. And they feel, you can see kind of like the defensiveness in them. But I think that's a natural part of when you're pushing and trying to do bold things. That's going to happen sometimes. And it's important to be forgiving of yourself when that comes up.
Do you want me to ask this one last one?
You're on mute now, Liz.
Fuck. Do you want me to ask this last one, Arik, then?
Yeah, do it.
All right, Clinton. Is making movies hard?
Yes, it is. It is very, very hard. It's honestly one of the hardest things you can do. But also the question that's more important is like, is it worth it to you? Because everything that is worthwhile is hard. And is making movies worth it to you?
Nice. Last question. Where should people go if they want to watch your work, support you, see more about you? Plug yourself. What should they do?
Just Google my name, Clinton Cornwell. There's not a lot of us in the world, so you'll find me. Honestly, I'm constantly adjusting my relationship with social media and the healthiness of it for myself mentally. Also, if you Google 12 months film, you'll find the link tree in the website for 12 months. It's on all the VOD platforms right now, and it'll be streaming in a couple months too. So let's all support each other by watching the movies.
Arik, what do you remember about our talk with Clinton?
I remember that he was, we've known Clinton for many years and talked to him, you know, but on the podcast, like he does you know, this like, I don't know if this is how I think of it. Filmmaker therapy, you know, mm-hmm. is this like consulting thing that he does where he'll just talk to you for 45 minutes to an hour and like talk through your problems with your creative, you know, your output or like where you are in your filmmaking or whatever, which was actually really helpful. I think I did two sessions with him.
Yeah.
And it was great. But yeah, I felt like he seemed more relaxed than I would expect, you know, especially with his feature coming out. Like he just seemed really relaxed and really confident in like his approach and like how he was making his movies or how he is making his movies. Yeah, you know, it was just fun to kind of get into a little bit of the philosophy, his process, like why he approached his first feature that way. And like why he went and made a, you know, a found footage horror film. I just thought it was all very interesting. I guess not necessarily what I expected. I don't know what I was expecting, I guess.
Yeah, he's an enigma. I see Clinton once a week because we do filmmaker hikes together in LA. If you're in LA and you're listening to this, you want to join our filmmaker hikes, please reach out. You're welcome to join us every Sunday at 10 a.m. And anything we say, Clinton is going to bring up on a hike, by the way. Like, he's going to be like, when you said thing about me being relaxed, here's what I want to say about that. So whatever I say is also going to, again, be noted. But my recollection of the conversation is that Clinton said something like how he doesn't want to be a marketer, right? He wants to use his energy for making of films. But I think Clinton is a marketer, because if you go, he's been doing these short little TikToks. He's been doing these little YouTube videos to promote his movie. He's actually doing a lot of marketing on his own to promote the release of 12 Months. He's reaching out to podcasters. He was on our show. So I think that, like, I don't know, maybe he doesn't want to be thought of as a marketer. Maybe in his mind, it's like a dirty word, but it's not. He's an entrepreneur. He's creating assets to build audiences, and he's doing a great job of it. So what I remember is that enigmatic thing as well, is that like he said one thing, but his action was another. And everyone should go see his movie, 12 Months, because it really is wonderful.
Amazing. You know what also is amazing? It is time for the game.
The game. What's the game, you ask? Why, it is a handmade homespun segment created by our producer, Eric Toms, where he puts forth a hypothetical. It's me, right? Reading this to you?
Yeah, it's you.
Okay.
Yeah, no, you're doing it.
It
yeah.
felt like so silent that I was like, and even though it's supposed to be silent, it felt like impressive silence.
I thought that was, we did like a perfect handoff. Like I got to do the game voice and then you got went right into it. I was like, man, this is fucking slick. We like nailed this shit.
I hope Jeff keeps in this fuck up, because I find it amusing that I'm like, silence is oppressive. I did something wrong.
Blooper.
So to finish the definition of the game, Eric Toms put forth a hypothetical scenario for one of us to answer blindly. We've never heard this before. Specifically, Auric has never heard this question before. And this question is for him. And he's just gonna see how he would tackle this problem, this hypothetical indie film problem. Okay. Auric, I guess it's for you, but you'll see why I'm confused. Auric, you've just completed a 2-week shoot for a romantic comedy. There we go. Okay. The film climaxes in a hand-to-hand fight scene between the two main characters. Interesting.
I love it already.
I know. I'm like, go on. During the course of the fight, the two characters succumb to their feelings and actually fall in love. The song being used in the scene is an incredible one-of-a-kind find that mixes beautiful melodies, heartbreaking lyrics, and a kick-ass beat. The music for the scene is supposed to be from a yet undiscovered up-and-coming band. However, from the time you plan the shoot to the time you get into post, the band blows up and becomes very popular. The record company comes to you and now demands that you pay an exorbitant amount of money to use the song in the film. The producer sheepishly approaches you and reveals that the deal they made with the record company was a handshake and there are no contracts. The amount of money the record company wants far exceeds the money you have in the budget. Do you? A, try and find a new song from the new band that will no doubt pale in comparison and may not even match the choreography in the scene. B, hire a band to try and mimic the sound of the original song, hoping that you don't get sued for copyright infringement. C, have a composer noodle on a guitar in the hopes that they come up with something that kind of works. D, other.
What do you do, director? What do you do?
Huh, that's a good one. This kind of happened to a previous guest of the show, Andrew Schrader.
Andrew Schrader.
His soundtrack for his latest feature, I think it's, yeah. It was a situation where, like, he knew the band. The band, like, you know, made music that was in the movie. And then, like, the record company was, like, holding it up or something like that. And so I think they ended up having just to get all new music, I think. I don't really remember all the details of this, but, like, I remember it was pretty tough for him to navigate that. But this is, like, more of a, it wasn't, like, music that was, like, in the movie in the same way as this question is. So I think it was probably easier to sort of navigate. But yeah, God, what would I do? And I'm assuming that, like, there is no workaround with the band and the music record, the record label. Like, they're basically not gonna, like, just be
that,
like,
could be
no,
another, that could be a D.
Actually, we will give you that original agreed upon amount. We're not evil.
Maybe
we will honor this. And like, here's what I would do as a series of actions. So I would go, if I knew the band personally, which it sounds like I would go to them and be like, hey, look, like, this is what the record label is trying to pull. I'm sure that you guys have a contract with them that allows them to do this. But, like, you know, I wonder if we can approach them together in good faith and request that this original agreement that we have, whether or not we don't have a contract or not, is honored, you know, just because you're making them a lot of money. Like, you're going to continue to make them a lot of money. You're making new songs, new music. This thing was really special. It's going to make more money for them anyways, because it's going to be in this movie that people are going to see, you know, even if it's not going to be like a humongous release, like, still people are going to see this movie and they're going to be fans that are going to come from this movie to the band. So I would just appeal to the record label and work with the band on that, you know, that would be my first step. And then my second step, if, like, let's say they are not going to budge and they're like, no, 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 like, we will not budge. Like, you have to pay this money. I would, like, either go to the original band and be like, well, look, is there a way that you can make a new song that's similar that, like, they don't own, you know, or, like, are they going to get involved in they have to be involved in every single thing. I basically just, like, work that angle until it was, like, dead. And, like, if that was not going to work, there's no way the original band could be involved. There's no way I can get the original song. Then I would go to a new band and I would, like, try to figure out, like, okay, like, how can we get something that's similar or different? I would look at the edit. I would, like, just see, like, what is a world where I can have a new song that will fit just as well, that's different, you know? And I'm sure, like, I don't know what I you know, it's funny, it's like, it depends on how specific it is, but I imagine there's always a way where something new could fit in and work just as well, if not better, than the original one, if you put the proper thought and process into it. So I wouldn't try to recreate the song. I would just make a new song that does the same thing as the old song, if every single other avenue is burned and will not work. But I would try that first. Anyways, what about you, Liz? What would you do?
Yeah, I think those are great answers. I only want to share resources. So, like, one is take the song that you love, and there's a way, this is very simple and obvious, but there's a way to just look up input songs and find out the BPM, the beats per minute of a song, and just the general pace of a song. And then often these services will give you, like, will spit out alternate songs that are similar in terms of pace. So just giving you a sense of, like, because I think one of the issues here is you have a baby and you're being confronted with the idea of killing your baby, right? We always talk about killing your darlings in art. So, like, the first thing is trying to separate yourself from the darling a little bit and trying to replace it with other songs, even if it doesn't fit, that have the same tone and Step one could be just looking up the BPMs, I believe is what it's called, and just finding other alternates. Step two is I was rejected by a band for Bread and Butter, and then I wrote a personal letter that was like, I think you're presuming we have more resources than we do. Here are the reasons why I love your song, and here's our budget, and here's actually what we're spending on this movie and why we can't afford this number. So it's not just like I'm secretly hiding money from you, record company and band, but I'm not. This is all of the money we have to give you. So, you know, I think what you're doing or what you're suggesting that you would do is the exact same thing. But I would just add that you don't have to show your bank account, but you recognize to them, it's not a money question. You deserve all the money in the world. We just don't have that, right? It's not about respect. Yeah. And the third example is the example everyone knows, but I'm just going to mention it anyway, is like the Jim Cummings Thunder Road example. And if you don't know this, please Google Jim Cummings Thunder Road, Bruce Springsteen. He did a one take short in like 2016, maybe around that 2016, 2017.
Yeah, around that time, yeah.
Where the one take was all to Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen, and he didn't have the rights. And there are many articles about him waiting in the office of either the master or the publishing, whoever owns the master or the publishing rights of that song, and him just going there every day and just respectfully asking for permission. And Bruce did give him permission, limited permission, to use the song. So there are worlds where you can be determined, respectfully determined, and be successful. And then there are worlds where you just kind of need to let go a little bit. So I would say try every world. Try every option.
Love it. That's fantastic. What do you guys think? What would you do in this situation? Have you had something like this happen before? How did you solve it? You can send us any thoughts on that or other questions, comments, or suggestions to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you really like the show, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or just a rating. Those are awesome as well. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks so much to Clint Cornwell for coming on the show. Thanks to editor Jeff Brimut for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert California Jones, for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for just being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week. That is unusable content. Nothing you can do with it. All right.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.